And so this is the backdrop where he decides to start Athletic Greens. He's completely broke. He's facing litigation and he's $5 million in debt. And he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start another company.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-Commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, joined by my co-host, Aaron Alpeter. Aaron, how's it going today?
Doing great, Nathan. How are you doing?
Amazing. So let's start. Tell us what E-Commerce on Tap is for those that haven't listened before.
Yeah, this is the highlight of my week. I don't know about you, but what we do is each week we take a well-known venture-backed company that's been in the headlines. We tell their founding story, reverse engineer their supply chain, and talk about what their exit opportunities are. So this week we're talking about Athletic Greens, or AG1 as they're known now. That is an all-in-one super supplement that we'll be going pretty deep into. But before we do that, I'd love to know what caught your eye this week.
Yeah, a few things. I mean, you know, this week I saw a few interesting tidbits that were like shocking to me. Number one, just I'm always amazed by the volume that these celebrities can draw with the launch of their brand. So Kylie Jenner launched a vodka soda brand called Sprinter. And in her first month, they shipped 140,000 cases, which is like insane. I mean, for anyone in the CPG kind of alcohol space to do that much volume in the first month is like mind blowing. The other thing that is also related to like creators and celebrities is Kim Kardashian and the Carlisle vet Jay Sammons. They launched Sky Partners like 18 months ago, and they had a target of raising $1 to $2 billion. The news kind of had all these headlines of Kim Kardashian launches $2 billion private equity fund focused on, you know, CPG brands. And they've only actually raised, it came out, $121 million of their $1 to $2 billion target. So I think it just like showcases that there's right now a lull in the market for kind of PE and CPG in terms of the convergence of that, because, you know, they haven't been able to raise that capital that they set out to fundraise. Last but not least, I guess two things quickly that caught my eye. Number one, Aaron, guess how much, if you weren't looking at the notes, guess how much Farmer's Dog is doing in revenue?
It's a lot. You know, they were one of my first clients when I was starting ISBA. They're a fantastic team, and I kind of wish I had gone with them. But how much of the revenue?
$800 million, it was reported. It's insane. I mean, their ads are everywhere, but to see the scale that they're out at now, I'm like, that is insane. I did not realize they were that big. That's incredible. And the last thing that caught my eye is FabFitFun acquired PupBox from Petco, which is like a, you know, monthly box for dogs and pets. And the founders launched PupBox in 2014, exited to Petco in 2017 at about $5 million in revenue. It looks like Petco scaled it, you know, quite a bit, but not like super big. But Petco stock is down and they're kind of offloading some of these sub products that they acquired. And so, you know, since their stock is down, since their IPO, they've sold this brand to FabFitFun. So that was kind of interesting how Petco is moving away from this subscription box.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a fine line between diversification and lack of focus. And it sounds like they're trying to err on the side of focus so that they sharpen their core business. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. What caught your eye this week?
So there was a whole slew of articles that came out that were kind of twofold. The first one was there are some pretty massive retailers, so like Levi Strauss, Skechers, Canada Goose, that historically have had a distribution model that each of them has kind of come to this realization that they need to have a D2C element themselves. And so they're looking at this and saying, hey, if I sell a jacket to somebody for $100 and they resell it for $200, why am I giving them that margin? Why can't I own that customer relationship and have that connection themselves? And so there's this confluence of really big companies that are now going D2C. And then every D2C brand that I know is either putting forward a retail strategy or has a retail strategy. And so the interesting thing here is I think that in 5 or 10 years, we're not going to have e-commerce companies or retail companies. We're just going to have companies. And everybody's going to have each of these channels. And this will be kind of how they go to market.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. That's pretty neat. Well, that's interesting tidbits for the week. Let's dive into Athletic Greens. I guess to start, give us an overview for those that are not familiar with Athletic Greens, you know, what the company does, who they are, and then we'll dive into, you know, the supplement market to start?
Yeah, so they have exactly one product. It is a supply chain person's dream from a planning point of view. They've got exactly one product that they sell, and it is a drinkable multivitamin probiotic called AG1. And the product that exists today has been iterated on over, I think, 52, 53 times. And the focus is really on quality, gut health, kind of absorption, nutrient absorption, things like that. And it's a really interesting kind of pioneer in the gut health space.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, supplements and the history of supplements are kind of crazy. Should we start there and then, you know, really dive into the AG1 story?
Yeah. How long do you think the concept of things that we add to our food or vitamins has been around?
That's a good question. I would guess like mid 1800s.
Close. So 1912 is the first time that we have something called a vitamin or an essential nutrient that's been identified. And it wasn't until 1920 when we had our first, what they called concentrated vitamin extracts. And so there were capsules that were then containing really unique vitamins like A vitamin, vitamin B, vitamin C. In 1938, Kellogg's, so the cereal company, they were known for adding vitamins to their cereal in a process that was known as fortification. And so this was kind of where it was starting to come into the known understanding that, hey, we're probably not getting all the nutrition that we need from our daily diet, so let's see if we can add stuff in there. And that kind of led to 1941. You think this is a wartime economy. President Roosevelt actually looked at ways to improve the American diet, and he caused this like food enrichment process in flour, right? So sometimes you see like it on, it says enriched flour. That was a process that Roosevelt helped spearhead, where they were adding things in there. Not a whole lot changed until the 90s. And then you have the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which defined what dietary supplements are. And so the basic definition here is a product, excluding tobacco, that is intended to supplement the diet and has one or more dietary ingredients. So it's a vitamin, a mineral, a herb, a botanical, an amino acid. And it talks about how the FDA is not authorized to review the safety and effectiveness of these dietary supplements. And so this really exists in a space where a lot of people take them. Over 50% of Americans take some sort of dietary supplement, but the FDA doesn't say like, this works or this is good. So it's this weird kind of middle ground that most people play in.
That's crazy. I mean, I think it's insane too, because to me, most Americans, at least that I know, probably the majority of them take some sort of supplement or, yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to see kind of how this market is really not that old, but has grown to be, I think, the majority of Americans kind of taking some sort of diet type of product or supplement, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting piece because we all believe that there's some efficacy there. Otherwise, why would we take it? But it's, again, it's really hard for anybody to kind of say this is what it is. And of course, you pay for your own studies and your own endorsements. And so we'll see this later that it's a very noisy category. It's hard to gain trust in this. I'm kind of speaking more broadly, dietary supplements and vitamins fall into the nutraceutical market. So you might have heard that term before. And they're typically used in prevention. And so they don't require a prescription that we talked about. And the thought is that, you know, you can't really claim that they have certain medical properties because then you'd have to run it through pharmacy protocols and certifications and things like that. But vitamins and supplements are about 26% of the total nutraceutical market. Everything else kind of gets into more things that require a prescription. And it's one of these things that it's growing very quickly, as you said. So it's grown for about 6.3% each year over year for the last 10 years. And it's expected to grow at that rate for at least until I think 2031 is what we saw. It's growing much faster in the US than it is in Europe and elsewhere. And this is really kind of tapping into this moment that the US is having around health and wellness and trying to be more customized. You also saw that the pandemic really supercharged the move toward health and wellness. And so just the general category, those sales grew by about 50% during 2020. And then you add that in with demographic changes, with a lot of elderly people as a percentage of the population, a lot of retirements, healthcare costs, those sorts of things. People see this as a way to lower those costs, and then that's something that they need as they age.
Yeah, I think what's crazy is one tidbit of information that we found out here is the industry has kind of been plagued by controversial situations and general consumer distrust because, you know, some of these supplements, it's hard to really correlate exactly, is this improving my health? And if so, you know, what exactly is it doing for my health? And in 1961, an FDA commissioner told the National Congress that the most widespread and expensive form of quackery was the promotion of vitamins and dietary supplements. So this has come a long way very quickly. And there's still doubts of this type of product that remain today. And I think that's why, you know, partially why the story is just so fascinating, because the market penetration of athletic greens happened pretty quickly. And especially to see the scale that they've gotten to today from a marketing standpoint and how much they're spending on marketing that we'll dive into a bit later is really eye-opening. Because, you know, just like 50 years ago, if AG1 launched, you know, if someone launched this type of product, like people would not trust this whatsoever, because there is no like direct measurable correlation for the most part. And athletic greens can't necessarily, like, they can't make claims per se that, okay, this is going to make you live longer, right? Like if athletic greens came out and said, you know, this is going to make you live longer, that would definitely end in a lawsuit for them, which they don't do, of course. But the athletic greens story starts with, you know, their kind of main founder, Chris Ashenden. He was born to great parents in New Zealand, and they prioritized family experiences. So they had a ton of family activities that, you know, ended up really pushing them or making them move from New Zealand to Japan and lived almost a year and a half backpacking in different countries all over the world. So Chris ended up living in 6 countries, visited over 70 others, which is just incredible. And he's been exposed to so many different international experiences as a kid that helped him build character. And I think his parents really instilled in him to respect cultures from around the world, which was super valuable to, you know, look up to and appreciate these different viewpoints. And he took an almost years long backpacking trip where as a family, they visited something like 44 different countries before he was 12. So like, I mean, as a kid, he was just seeing the world. It sounds like almost like a dream childhood for me because I love to travel. And I do think, you know, you learn so much through travel. So it is really cool to see, you know, his family history instilled so much travel and global culture.
Yeah, and I think the kind of key thing here is that he's incredibly close to this family, and that's going to become very important later on. You know, this idea of kind of a shared experience where they're going around and meeting different things was really formative for him and kind of how he approached where he is. I mean, even today, he kind of moves around, lives in Colombia part of the year, and just kind of picks different countries and wants to go experience those sorts of things.
What impact do you think that life experience, you know, traveling early on as a family had on his philosophy, right? I mean, like he goes to the University of Auckland, but he studies sports exercise science, which I don't know if that was necessarily inspired by his travel, but, you know, it's interesting to see how that ties into his life.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely picked up his initial health issues while on his backpacking trip. So I think he ended up getting hepatitis in India or something like that. And so spent a good chunk of that backpacking trip sick. And so that was maybe a negative outcome, but one was formative. But I think when it comes to his family dynamics, this was one where he had a very supportive environment, people who he felt he could talk to, who would be able to push him, tell him what he needed to do, call him out. And so he had this great infrastructure. And, you know, every founder that I know that's successful has some sort of support system, whether that be a spouse, a significant other, family, or just a cohort of people that you know are going through that shared experience, because it is difficult to start a company. And the fact that you've got people that you can rely on that care about you and love you regardless of, you know, how much money is in the bank account or what your latest valuation was, is something that, you know, money can't buy.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And we see it in his story because, I mean, he didn't attend class too much, but, you know, he dropped out of college with 2 classes to go to start a sports supplement business that ultimately failed. So he convinced his then part-time employer to be his partner in the business, and he lost around $10,000, which was, you know, a lot of money for a college student. he initially had blamed his partners for the failure. But I mean, I think he looked inwards, right? Because, you know, most founders, from my opinion, don't necessarily go back to a failed idea, but it does remind me actually of the Vuori story, right? If you recall a few episodes back, the Vuori founder tried to launch a apparel business like two times prior to Vuori. And so he kept going back. And so, you know, Chris similarly kept going back to this sports supplement idea. What happened after that initial failure?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So I think he was really jaded because of how this had happened. And he carried that angst and that blame for several years. And he was really bouncing around from job to job. He did, you know, he was two classes short of his degree, never went back to finish. And he just kind of picked up odd jobs. He was doing lots of sales jobs and those sorts of things, which ended up being good training for him. But he seemed to be kind of like an angry young man. And he got into boxing and martial arts as a way to blow off some steam. He was a big Bruce Lee fan. I don't know if we mentioned that. That's why he got into nutrition to begin with. I think part of that was living in Japan and kind of seeing all those sorts of things. But he tells a story about how he was at a ring with one of his sparring partners and, you know, maybe that he had just kind of beaten up this guy. And it just mentioned, like, hey, you know, it seems that you're really kind of rudderless. You're bouncing from job to job. Maybe you should do something to help the community. He's like, well, what? It's like, well, have you ever considered being a police officer? He's like, yeah, sure. I could be a cop. Why not? And so he joined the police force and was a police officer in New Zealand for about 3 years. And he found that, wow, he suddenly had a steady job and people were more than happy to see him as a police officer and be willing to give him credit. And he was still very much growing and maturing as a person and was spending more than he was bringing in just from a lifestyle point of view. And so he kind of blinked and looked up and he was $62,000 in debt. And again, a lot of money for a young person, especially when you're on a police person's salary. And so, you know, I think partially realizing that, like, hey, the lifestyle that I want, I can't really fund on credit forever. And mixed with this idea of like, I've got this hole, I got to fix it. He started to think about, okay, how do I get back to entrepreneurship? And how do I have this itch that I need to scratch to start something? And so he started doing some research, started reading some books, and decided that he wanted to get into real estate. And he did a couple of deals while he was still a police officer. And they were kind of what you'd expect to see on TikTok, which were these highly levered transactions where, you know, I'm putting 99% money in a loan to buy something. And, you know, I'm going to try to fix it up quickly and flip it. And that's kind of what he did. And he was doing that for a little bit and was trying to figure out, okay, how do I make this an actual company? How do I do a little bit more? And he talks about something that was a pretty formative experience for him in his, I guess, entrepreneurship journey. And that was when he attended a seminar in New Zealand by a business coach named Keith Cunningham. And it was a weekend seminar with about 25 other people. And he had kind of signed up expecting to have some tips like, hey, here's how you raise money from investors. And it was an interactive session. And Chris got up and spoke in front of the group. And Keith asked him questions for about an hour. They talked about his venture that had failed and what wasn't happening, and which is a very good listener. And Keith kind of keyed in on a few things that he had said and then decided to give him an assignment that he said changed his life. He told him that he needed to go home and start taking ownership of his failures. And his homework was that he was going to write down 50 things that he did wrong or should have done differently that led to his failures. And this was him taking 100% responsibility. There was no blaming others. There was no justifying things. It was, I need to write down, like, these are the mistakes that I made that resulted in this failure of this company. And he really took that to heart. He said that he was moved by it, went home after the course and stared at a blank page for about 2 hours. And then it started to flow and he started to recognize where he could have been better. And he came up with about 76 things that he felt he could have done or should have done better. And this idea of radical ownership was eye-opening for him because he went from feeling like the victim of a business situation to feeling like he had all the power in the world. And he was a millionaire only 6 months after kind of going through this.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, I think more founders and just people in general should do this, right? I feel like so many people point their fingers when really the most learning often comes from looking inwards, right? And so I think this was a really powerful exercise. I mean, I'm kind of curious for our audience. I mean, who has looked inwards before and done an exercise like this? I mean, I know I've done a lot of, you know, reflection through my career and life to try to understand, like, how can I better improve myself? Because I think really at the end of the day, like, you know, that's the most empowering and powerful thing to do, is to look inward instead of oftentimes pointing blame at others. And I mean, I think this was a pivotal moment in his career, right? Because without this exercise, I mean, he probably would have gone on to just continue to point blame at other partners for his shortcomings, right?
Yeah. I mean, how many times have you met somebody who's just waiting for life to happen to them, right? They're just kind of like, oh, when I get this opportunity, or when this thing happens for me, like, you know, like, no, like, the idea here is go make your own luck. Go put yourself in those positions and those circumstances so that things have an opportunity to succeed. And, you know, whether it is, you know, go back to the Merit Beauty episode, and whether it's someone saying, you know what, I don't want to go to school, I'm going to volunteer and work at a TV studio, a movie studio, so that I just get exposure to this, or I take these opportunities that come up. Like, there is a common thread here where you say, I'm going to own this, I'm going to do it, I'm not willing to let life just happen to me. And this is really something that percolates beyond just business. And, you know, if you are upset about the relationship you have with your parents, and you're worried about, hey, maybe I don't have as much time with them left, well, guess what? You can control that, right? You can take them out to dinner, you can call them, you can plan vacations. You don't have to wait for someone else to make the move. And Chris really kind of, this was a crucible. And he said that his two keys for success that he gives to everybody when they ask for coaching is just get started and keep going. And it's this idea of like, don't wait for things to happen. Just start doing something now, even if it's small. You just got to get that momentum rolling.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think this was a huge takeaway for his life and career, and really set him on a great trajectory. And we see that, because now that he's taking ownership, he quits the police after he used up all of his vacation and went full time into real estate in New Zealand, actually. So he basically implemented lots of highly levered home purchases. And it kind of eventually turned into a somewhat of a misleading business, where people receive mortgages and move into houses that they thought they owned, but in reality, they had the right to own after a 30-year mortgage was paid off. And so business was good, but his health was really bad. And he kept kind of dabbling with nutrition and health, but he had a lot of serious health challenges as he tried to, you know, scale this up. So he had no energy, respiratory infections 3 to 4 times a year, going to the bathroom, he says, like 15 to 20 times a day. And, you know, real like doctors that he would go to in New Zealand and Australia couldn't help him. And he was also in a bad headspace, because I think he was just under a lot of stress, you know, with the leverage that he was taking on. And so his sisters noticed that he wasn't, you know, his normal happy self. And they told him that they were concerned, that they thought he was depressed. And so he took 9 months off, started traveling the world again, gave up drinking, and started removing people, things, and habits from his life that weren't making him happy, which I think is like a super important exercise. I think it kind of goes into like leaning inwards, right? Because a lot of times you think that other people control your emotions, or other people, you know, kind of control your habits. But really, you know, this is showcasing how Chris continues to lean inward, which is awesome. And so around this time, he moves to America and starts seeing specialists for his health issues. He spent $35,000 to get every blood and stool test, resulting in 51 vials of blood being taken in one sitting, which is just insane. They ruled out cancer, but found out that he basically wasn't getting or absorbing the nutrients his body needed. And the doctors made a pill that was going to cost him about $100 a day. And it was just some, you know, cocktail to solve his problems.
50 pills a day is what they prescribed to him, which is,
yeah, it's
a lot.
Insane. And so they came to the conclusion that everything he had learned about nutrition was wrong. And, you know, specifically, he was focusing on the idea of gut health and nutrition absorption, which I think, you know, at the time, not too many people were looking into. And so that was a really unique insight at the time as well. But, you know, it seemed like everything was difficult for him around this time. But, you know, this was a major insight for him. But, you know, what happened kind of after he has this insight? Because the economy takes a turn. This is like 2008 timeline that we're talking about right now.
Yeah. What happened in 2008 in real estate? Not good things, right? You had the global economic collapse. And basically, very quickly, his real estate company began to just fall apart. And to the point where he was actually prosecuted and convicted in 2011 of misleading borrowers in New Zealand with this complicated structure they put up. And he was ordered to pay $237,000. You know, we talked about how close-knit his family was and how much they meant to him. Well, his parents had retired, and they didn't have any existing cash flow after they retired. And so Chris had invited them to invest, take you know, some money out of their house and invest in his business. And that way, you know, they'd be able to share in his success and it would do well. And that worked well for a little bit, but then the business went sideways and his parents lost their home and basically all of their life savings that they had put towards them. So that you can imagine how much that just killed him and how difficult that was. You know, the litigation that he faced ended up killing the real estate business, and he found himself very quickly in debt to the tune of about $5 million. And at this point, again, he's living in the U.S. in Miami, and he ran out of cash. He just stopped paying his rent, and he had given like a 3-month security deposit and basically wasn't paying rent and was just living in his apartment until he got kicked out because his security deposit expired. And the landlord called him every day to yell at him. And after he lost his apartment, he spent several months just living on people's couches. And he told himself, you know, on one of his lower days, he opened up his bank statement on his phone and took a screenshot and just saved that into a folder for stories later. And the thought was like, hey, this is as bad as it's going to get. And so this is the backdrop where he decides to start Athletic Greens. He's completely broke. He, you know, is facing litigation and he's $5 million in debt. And he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start another company. And I don't know if this was, again, this fight or flight instinct where he's like, I have to dig myself out of this because I can't just let life happen to me. But this is what he looked to do.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty interesting and just shows the character of who Chris is, because most people in this situation would say, okay, I need to go get a stable, like 9-to-5 job. And he goes kind of the opposite way, starts, you know, traveling to live in cheaper countries like Argentina, and goes and starts, you know, his own company. And so, you know, this is about the time where he meets Tim Ferriss in 2011 in a coffee shop in Buenos Aires. And if you've read 4-Hour Body, he's kind of mentioned as like the Kiwi friend Chris in there, which is pretty cool. And for those that, you know, don't know Tim Ferriss, he's, you know, really, I think, a fundamental entrepreneur for so many other founders out there to learn from. You know, he's got a whole 4-hour book series. 4-Hour Workweek was, you know, one of the best New York Times bestsellers out there. And Tim Ferriss had actually created a supplements brand called Brain Quicken, which he kind of, you know, transformed from an 80-hour work week when he was starting to a 4-hour work week while making $50,000 a month. And Brain Quicken was actually the reason why Tim Ferriss became, you know, Tim Ferriss. That was kind of his whole mantra, and the business breakdown of Brain Quicken is in the 4-Hour Workweek book, which is pretty cool. And so Tim Ferriss sold that to a PE firm in London in 2011. And when asked why he sold the business that was doing $50,000 a month in profit and funding his lifestyle, he told a story about how he's traveling with a friend in Mexico and showed him how he ran his business about 20 minutes. And the friend asked, let me know if you ever are interested in selling. And they eventually agreed upon a price. So, you know, there's nothing that necessarily directly says that Chris was inspired by Tim, but there's definitely a lot of correlation here. And there was a tweet from Brain Quicken in 2011 announcing the launch of their new product, Athletic Greens. And so it's not like explicitly said that Tim Ferriss is a founder of Athletic Greens, but like they were very close, you know, in the same city. Chris has mentioned, you know, a few times in the book. I mean, how involved do you think Tim Ferriss is with Athletic Greens?
I mean, I'm going to go on a limb and say that he's the founder of Athletic Greens here. I mean, there's a lot of smoke to this sort of thing. And the fact that there's a tweet from 2011 that from Brain Quicken that says, hey, we can't wait to launch our new product, Athletic Greens. It's like, well, wait a minute. Like, how is this? I know that from the research I did that Tim was really, even though it was only 4 hours a week, it was still occupying a lot of his brain space. And so he was looking for a clean break. And so even if he started Brain Quicken, which he did, and even if he sold it to Chris, which we think he did, Tim wanted to walk away and kind of give, just step away. But there's an interesting pedigree with this particular company. And so I think that Chris is still the founder of Athletic Greens, but he may have been starting with a Brain Quicken business as his template.
Yeah, definitely been inspired and you know, maybe even some sort of early partnership of that sorts. But how did Chris go about developing AG1? Because it is, you know, a lot different than Brain Quicken's, you know, main product that Tim Ferriss was selling.
Yeah, well, we should also mention that AG1 would not be AG1 without Tim Ferriss. I think it's a very important thing to do because he actually called out Athletic Greens in the 4-Hour Body, which, you know, came out in the early 2010s. And so it was kind of a funny story. Chris had thought that maybe he named the company the wrong name because it was kind of misleading for what it was. And so he's like, he called up his friend Tim and says, "Hey, I'm thinking about changing it." Tim's like, "I wouldn't do that because I just named you in the book and it's going out to print." And so this is one of these things where AG1 would not be AG1 without Tim's endorsement. And as he has gained in popularity, people have read his book and listened to his podcast and followed and tried to pattern their life after his, AG1 has been a direct beneficiary of that. And so it's interesting that's kind of was, but I think it's important to say again that the Brain Quicken business is very different from what Athletic Greens became.
Totally. Yeah. That's a really, really good note. And I mean, Chris did, you know, assemble a team of experts who started with like a white space to create what, you know, they say has become the ultimate all-in-one supplement and what that might look like. I mean, what kind of customer base was he really keeping in mind when they were developing this?
Yeah. So keep in mind that Chris had had health problems for pretty much his entire adult life, and he had found something that worked. It was $100 a day and it was 50 pills. And so his first customer was himself. He's like, "I have to find something that I can take every day that is going to replace having to take all these pills. It will make me feel even better." So his first customer was himself. And then his second customer was his mom and dad. And so again, coming back to this really tight family unit that's there, and you know, that's what they had. And so the idea was really to do something that hadn't been done at the time. They wanted to create a powder that had all the nutrients that someone would need that would replace 16 to 20 different pills that they'd have to take otherwise. And the product today contains about 75 different vitamins, minerals, whole foods, superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens in one serving. And like I said at the top of the episode, it's been reformulated over 50 times. And so as they learn something new, as they figure out a way to tweak it, they're not willing just to let it go. They're continuing messing with it. And so, you know, at the beginning and even today, they would probably claim that their product is over-engineered. But that being said, like, again, this is not FDA regulated. It's not FDA approved. But that's the basic idea.
Yeah. I mean, they've definitely done a lot of iterations of AG1, but, you know, basically the whole premise is the user or the customer takes a scoop of their green powder, mixes it with water, ideally first thing in the morning on an empty stomach. And this is supposed to help the body absorb the nutrients better and faster. And it's a better user experience because, you know, without AG1, they say, you know, you would have to take 20 different capsules or pills to get the same ingredients. And so, you know, they have this quote unquote over-engineered product. What was their go-to-market like? I mean, this is, you know, an interesting playbook.
Yeah, I don't know if it's one that I would recommend, but you know, you look at how competitive this space is today, and there are entire factories and groups of co-packers that white label supplements. And so it's one of these things where, you know, if I'm an athlete or I have a social media following or I just decide that I can have a unique marketing angle, I'm going to go out, I'm going to find something that is good, and I'm going to focus on my marketing, my DTC acquisition, and kind of maximizing shelf space. That is the playbook that 99% of companies in the supplement space do. What Chris did is he actually built the business backwards. He didn't focus on the market, right? He didn't focus on the willingness to pay by the consumer. He really just had this mandate that he created to make the best possible product. And they were like, all right, if I can find the best, if I have two choices between a higher quality ingredient and a cheaper ingredient, I'm going to choose the higher quality ingredient every time. And you know, they were able to iterate. They made some things that came together, and they had lots of advisors who had run 100 million plus nutraceutical companies. And they looked at the product and said, "This is awesome. This is a great product. Then I looked at the business. I said, this is never going to work. Your margins are way too low. And this isn't really what's going to be there. And you look at AG1, it's an expensive product. It's about, you know, $100 a month. If you're getting it one off, it's $79 a month if you're on a subscription. But many times as he's facing these forks in the road, his advisors, his investors, him, you know, his team would say, hey, I think that maybe we should trade down on some of these ingredients to improve the margin. And his thought is like, we're going to be sacrificing quality a little bit and we're not going to do that. And so, you know, that was kind of his thought of how he approached that go to market.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty incredible how focused he was on product and making this the best supplement on the market. And he led with, you know, top tier pharma safety standards, which is, you know, the NSF certificate as well as the TGA certification. And so that was, you know, their highest quality standard. And he insisted on the absolute best type of ingredients. So I think they were, you know, basically the first to pioneer having this many ingredients and nutrients all in one supplement, and really, you know, pioneered kind of this powder form instead of capsule or pill form. But I mean, it's pretty crazy because when Chris is, you know, launching, he starts out with $500,000 in inventory. So he's able to find some early investors, but, you know, to place a $500,000 PO right off the bat and incur like $4,000 to $6,000 in warehousing and other ongoing expenses, I mean, that's a lot right off the bat. I mean, how do you think he was feeling when they placed that first PO?
You know, probably excited. I think he probably, I would imagine, genuinely felt like, hey, I found something that I wish I had, right? This is solving a very specific problem that I had. And I'm sure there's other people that, you know, have similar issues or are going to benefit by him. So I think that he believed that they have built a great product, but it's just like, how do you market this, right? We called it Athletic Greens. We probably need to call it something else. I think they iterated on a bunch of other names throughout time as well. But the problem that they had really was it didn't taste great, right? So you think about the Athletic Brewing episode that we had. And, you know, the thing there was they created an Athletic Brewing. They created something that was different that people maybe had a stigma against, but it tasted great. It was fine. This didn't taste very good at all. And, you know, Chris also refused to add in extra sweeteners that weren't helpful or were actually harmful to gut health. And so this was a bit of a barrier. And he kind of started to market this as like, hey, it's the taste of health. Right? Why did you think this was going to be easy? Why did you think you were going to take a miracle pill and go back and eat chicken wings and, you know, mozzarella sticks and think you're healthy? And, you know, if you look at, and this is still something they're dealing with today, because if you look at review after review after review, they talk about, you know, one scoop of AG1 in water is tough to swallow. And even in a smoothie, it's got an unpleasant powdery mouthfeel. And I think mine arrives tomorrow, so I'll tell you how it goes. But it's a very difficult thing to do. And just supplements in general are a hard category to get credibility, like we talked about.
Yeah, I mean, talk about just being so product focused, right? Because, you know, I think most founders would have added sweetener and tried to make it taste better. And especially after that Forbes review, they probably would have changed the formula. But I mean, I think, you know, there has been a lot of controversies on the product. I mean, like other supplements in the industry, nutrition experts often mention that these types of products kind of give a false sensation that we're in control of our health. And AG1 has been linked to, you know, some slogans like that in the past. But, you know, there are sources complaining of the many, you know, health benefits the product seems to have. And, you know, it's kind of like this dynamic where, you know, is it like a placebo type of effect? Is it actually legit? And it's hard because you can't make false claims, right? I mean, that's, you know, I think there's a very, you know, fine line when it comes to marketing a product like AG1 of not making false claims. But most of their growth came from winning over health influencers like Tim Ferriss that we talked about, Andrew Huberman, or other celebrities like Conan O'Brien or Joe Rogan or Peter Thiel, who had, you know, direct experience with AG1. I'm curious, you placed a test order and they kind of have a unique hook here. I think that was another cool growth strategy that they've implemented.
Yeah, so they're not going to win any taste tests, right? And so it's something here where they have found that through their celebrity endorsements that it's really about people saying, hey, this worked. And so I thought it was pretty interesting that I checked out and I placed the order. And in my confirmation email, they said, hey, you know, if you email this code to 5 friends and they sign up, well, one, we're going to give them a free sample. But then two, you know, if they order, you'll get some money back. So I said, sure, let me just go through the experience and do it. And so I sent a text to my siblings. And the text, this is the default text, that AG1 has been a game changer for me. It's an all-in-one daily drink with 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients. And it was something where my siblings were like, really? Like, have you had this? I'm like, no, that was just the text. Like, oh, so you're spamming me. But it was just this interesting idea that like they are saying, hey, here's the endorsement we want. Please go say it. And just they know it works, at least for them.
Yeah, that's crazy. I wonder how much they've tested that copy for kind of that that affiliate text that they do to
probably
friends.
Probably a lot. If you can fake an endorsement from a friend, that's just you can't beat that.
Yeah, that's nuts. I mean, I think too, they've really aligned so well with these influencers and celebrities. I mean, you know, so many different podcasts talk about them. I mean, it's reported that AG1 spends over $2 million a month on podcasts today, which is like insane.
We're open for sponsorship if they got more of that money they want to throw around.
Yeah. We definitely would be open to some AG1 sponsorship. But, you know, their customer base are 50% male, 50% female is what, you know, it kind of says, and typically between 30 and 50 years old. What's crazy is that there is such limited data on revenue as they grew. They started advertising heavily on podcasts in 2015, but I just can't get away because like we've covered so many different brands here on E-commerce on Tap, and almost always we're able to find, you know, someone reporting revenue or saying a revenue number in a different podcast interview or on a different, you know, news mention or whatever it may be. With Athletic Greens, there is such limited data on their revenue, which is like insane because Aaron, you know, people at AG1 and they said that they like don't even report it to their team. I mean, it's pretty nuts, right?
Yeah, it was pretty secretive there. And so I'm sure some people knew and they were just being coy and they just have good discipline, I guess, to not tell. But it's really interesting where most other companies are very interested in shouting that from the rooftops and say, hey, you know, we made $25,000 today. And like, that's cool. That's a vanity thing, but it's probably a smart thing to keep your revenue numbers close.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's impressive that they've kept it secret for so long. But, you know, one number we were able to find is that they raised $125 million from venture in 2021. They claim they could have held out for longer, but they wanted to invest more in their supply chain. And I think what's crazy too is to this day, you can only get AG1 on their own website. So they are famously not on Amazon. And they're intentionally focused on owning the customer relationship. And they feel like Amazon is a blocker for them with that.
Yeah, that to me is surprising. And maybe there's some strategy to it that we'll get to later. But the fact that they are not on Amazon and they are, they created this category, right? They were the ones to pioneer the powder, the all-in-one. Every other competitor that has come up and says, we're like Athletic Greens, except cheaper or except whatever, right? And so they have ceded this particular market, these channels, to competitors like Huel that are doing millions or tens of millions of dollars on a given month, you know, through Amazon. So it's a very interesting thing that way.
Yeah. And I mean, so they're $79 per month. The product's considered pricey, too pricey by many. But, you know, there's definitely been a ton of TikTok posts bearing the hashtag AG partner. After the 2022 funding announcement, and that's been viewed over 38 million times across TikTok. And it's just, you know, they invest a ton in marketing, which is pretty incredible to see. Let's talk about the overall timeline of the company. So 2009, the company is founded by Chris Ashton. 2015, Adam Trouncer, an engineer with finance background, replaces Chris as the CEO. 2018, Chris rebranded the product to Athletic Greens. 2021, they're estimated to be at $100 million in revenue, and Kat Cole joins the company as president and COO, with Chris retaking his role as CEO.
To put her on the list of people that I would love to meet sometime, but she just has an amazing story. So she grew up with a very, very difficult early life. I think single mom, very, very poor, from a young age was working to help support her family. And she was the first one to go to college on either side of her family. And she actually started working at Hooters to help pay for school. And she, you know, was very helpful there, was learning kind of how to run the store, and ends up getting hired full time by Hooters corporate. And she drops out of school, joins Hooters. And basically what her job is for the next several years is to go around the world opening up different restaurants. And so, you know, and this just tells you everything you need to know about her. They offered her the job to open up a store in Australia, and she said yes, and then had to go get a passport. And the first time she ever left the country was because she was going to do this. And so she spent, again, several years doing this all over the world, really opening these things up. By age 26, she's a vice president at Hooters, and she spends about 14 years total at the company. She ends up leaving to be the CEO of Cinnabon, I think at like age 31 or something like that. Basically completely revitalizes the brand, returns them to growth, improves their profitability, and then is asked by the parent company, the holding company of Cinnabon, to start doing that for the three or four other big brands that they had in there. And, you know, here she is in her mid-30s, and she's leading, you know, multiple billions of dollars worth of work. She got an MBA online, you know, as she's just because she wanted to have a degree. And she kind of decides for herself that she wants to take a little bit of a break, and she decides that she wants to go to something smaller. And so she ends up, you know, getting connected with Chris and decides that, you know, this is something that she believes in. She loves where it is. It's a small company only doing $100 million. And so she wants to get involved, and she will put her fingerprints on. It's just a fascinating story. And I think we could have a whole episode about Kat.
Yeah, we should. I mean, I've listened to her on a few different podcasts, and it's incredible to see her story and who she is. I mean, it's pretty amazing. But so during that time, they rebrand to AG1, kind of from Athletic Greens to AG1. What do you think was kind of the reasoning behind that rebrand?
Well, I think that Chris never liked Athletic Greens as a name. I mean, he was trying to change it in 2011, and it just kind of stuck. Right? It was in the book with Tim Ferriss, and so he kind of left it. And I think that, you know, there are difficulties with the idea of Athletic Greens. It's like, oh, it's only one thing, and this, why is this so expensive if it's just these ingredients? And this is really meant to be kind of your all-in-one full daily supplement.
Yeah. It sounds a little techie too, AG1. You know, gives me the ring of a more techie, sleek type of name. But to wrap up their timeline, 2022, they complete a Series B round for $115 million with 26 investors participating. It was led by Alpha Wave Global, and it valued the company at $1.2 billion. Let's talk about their supply chain. What was unique about their supply chain?
Yeah, I think what really stuck out to me is how ridiculously simple of a supply chain it is. And they don't own any of it. They just have really tight partnerships. So again, they have a single product, and there's basically just two SKUs. There's a trial pack and a tub, but the product is exactly the same. And so there is an enormous amount of discipline and just focus on making sure that blend is exactly what they want to do. They manufacture in New Zealand. They're using a company called Aleron. And it's really one of these things that, again, they pride themselves on basically finding the highest quality standards that are out there and saying, cool, we're going to do that and then some. And so you talked about, you know, the Therapeutic Goods Administration out of Australia, or GMP or NSF, you know, basically any three-letter acronym they are using as kind of thought there. They do have some ancillary products that kind of enable the product. So when you sign up for AG1, you get a tub of the actual product, then they send you like a water bottle and a scoop and things like that. They're sourcing those from China. But the really interesting thing here is that it's, like you said, all driven by their D2C site. And it's, you know, a monthly subscription is still their main thing, which is interesting. They do offer a one-off purchase, but the price premium is like $30 more. And so you're looking at this and saying, okay, maybe I don't want to do that. Maybe I will sign up, and worst case scenario, I'll cancel. Yeah, you know, you look at this, you see some things that are being sold on Amazon or Walmart, but these are resellers. These are people who probably have a subscription, are buying it $79, then selling it for $90 or something like that. But it's a really interesting thing. I think, you know, we haven't really covered too many companies that have only one SKU, and they've had one SKU the whole time. And rather than creating 50 different versions of it, they're just saying, all right, we're going to improve it and then get rid of the old one, improve it and get rid of the old one. And so it's a really interesting piece around just their focus and approach to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to see the scale that they've gotten to with one SKU. There are very, very few companies that have one SKU and get to this scale. So, I mean, I think it's just amazing to see that they've been able to get there, you know, just focusing in on this one product, really. I mean, I'm curious what conversations they've had to expand to other SKUs. I mean, I feel like they have such a strong customer base that there must be discussions of expanding SKUs in terms of other, you know, more specific type of supplements. I mean, do you think they're forever going to be a one SKU company, or do you think they'll eventually expand into other SKUs?
You know, it's a good question. I personally think that they should expand into something else. It could be an adjacent category, but I think it's going to be important to show that their brand has the opportunity to be a hero brand or a master brand. And so, you know, the master brand idea is something like, you think about Dove, right? Dove is shampoo. It is soap. It is, you know, baby wash and body wash and things like that. You can take that a bunch of different ways because it means more than just the product. Right now, AG1 and the product, the brand and the product are the same thing. And so it's important from an acquisition perspective to see where they can take that. And so maybe there's an AG1, competitor to emergency, right? Something that's going to help you when you're sick, or something else they could play with that would be an interesting thing.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a bit about their exit opportunities too, right? Because so their last round was at $1.2 billion. I guess, you know, there are an enormous number of supplement companies that could potentially acquire them. But let's start with the question, are they profitable? It's unclear if they're profitable or not, but given, you know, the size of their revenue, the relatively low amount of money that they've raised, I think we should assume that they are profitable. I mean, what do you think their kind of acquisition potential or targets look like?
Yeah, again, I think that table stakes is you have to be profitable. Money earning businesses want to buy other money earning businesses. They don't want to lose money. So that's table stakes. You know, I think about as I go through the progression of my mind is, you know, the next one is, do they have a plus one? And that is, again, that unique something that they have that an acquirer is going to see that they can infuse into all of the other work that they do. And I would imagine by this point, they have assembled some of the best gut health data or researchers out there. And so they are probably one of the leaders when it comes to gut health research and just understanding that. And that's something that could be incredibly valuable. Companies like Nestle and Danone have very publicly said, like, hey, we believe in gut health, we're going to do this. But they've only spent $4 million a year on this sort of thing, which, don't get me wrong, I wouldn't want to write that check. If they're passing out $4 million, I'll take it. But when you come to the scale of what this opportunity could be, AG1 has invested so much more and has this corpus of data that could be super helpful for an acquirer to learn and to get through. So I think that that's their interesting plus one. Would a company like Danone, who's a $43 billion market cap company, would they be interested in spending $1 billion, or in this case, you know, a couple billion dollars, given where the valuation is? Maybe. But then you look at, okay, it's historically a low margin business, and, you know, they have other options available for higher margin competitors. And so it's really going to be a question of how much can AG1 continue to lower their costs? And then, you know, how much would an acquirer value their gut health research?
Yeah. And there's also a lot of easy wins here, right? Because, you know, let's say an acquirer comes in, buys AG1, they can expand channels through retail and Amazon. They could, which I think would easily potentially double the business. And they could also introduce adjacent products like, you know, a healthy beverage or healthy snacks. You know, there have been rumors of an IPO for AG1, which would be pretty incredible. I think it's, you know, rare that you see a single product SKU go public. But I guess an example of an acquisition in the industry is Unilever purchasing Nutrafol for $1 billion off an estimated 150 to 107 million in revenue in 2021. And so it's interesting to see, you know, there have been $1 billion acquisitions in the industry.
Actually, about 160 million is what's estimated.
Yeah. So I think it's in that range, right? So there is opportunity for a $1 billion outcome here, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the problem, though, is that their latest valuation was $1.2 billion. And so if they get an offer for $1.1, $1.2, $1.3, that's not going to be interesting. And so these investors have basically made a bet that AG1 is going to be able to double or triple or quadruple their current revenue to get the multiple that's going to make sense for them. So it's something where even if there is an opportunity, you know, by a Nestle, for example, to come in and purchase AG1 for $1.4, $1.5 billion, I think that there's going to be some internal pressure from the board to say, hey, no, we want to hold out. We want to keep selling. And it's possible that they could miss their window from an acquisition point of view as they're, you know, working through things.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, too, if we look at how they've scaled, they've been early to new channels, right? I mean, not many people were advertising on podcasts in 2015. You know, not many people got to that scale of podcast advertising that they did. And, you know, not many people were able to scale a influencer driven hashtag on TikTok like they did. And so I think they're going to continue to try to find these underutilized channels to expand. I mean, they obviously spend a lot on advertising, but I think sometimes in like a untraditional sense, right? They're not just pouring it all into Meta. You know, they're really trying to find unique channels here that are less competitive than, you know, your more traditional channels.
For sure.
This was awesome. I mean, Athletic Greens, AG1, I think one of the coolest stories we've had on e-commerce on tap. I mean, the single SKU story and just the resilience of Chris to lean into his past failure and start another supplement brand and this time become wildly successful is incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that his story and I think the authenticity that he brings as he's looking through this is important. I mean, this is someone who has made a lot of mistakes in his life, has done things that he wishes he could do differently, that he is not proud of, but who hasn't, right? I know I've certainly been that way. And the fact that I think the piece I took away is just this radical commitment to ownership and understanding that, you know, it's not something, well, I should have hired a better person or I should have fired that person earlier. But no, like every time something is wrong, you look directly in the mirror and say, how did I screw this up? And what's the lesson I'm going to learn here? That pain of the failure is not going to go away. You can make the anger go away by not blaming other people. And you have to come back and take a look at it and say, okay, what am I supposed to be learning here? You know, I just lost $1 million or I'm in debt by $5 million. What's the lesson that I'm paying $5 million in tuition for that I have to learn so I don't repeat it again? I think to me, that's really the great thing here that's there. And obviously, amazing company just from a simplicity point of view, but also doing a very complex product in a way that hadn't been done before. I mean, they invented a new category of this all-in-one. They invented a new form factor in the powders. And that's something where I think really focusing on the product, focusing on that user experience paid dividends. Where I think most people are just like, I want to do supplements and here's my thought. And I'm not willing to go through this amount of pain. I just want to get a quick read on if this is going to be successful or not, if it's not going to be successful.
Totally, totally. I'm curious for our audience, for those tuning in, if you were on AG1's team, what product would you expand into? So is it, you know, a line of gut nutrition? Is it, you know, a health-driven drink? What product would you expand into? Tweet or tag Aaron and I on LinkedIn with your answer. And thank you again for tuning in and listening in to this episode of E-commerce on Tap brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. Leave a like, comment, review, share it with a friend. We really appreciate it. And thank you again for tuning in.